And we are live just a few minutes late. I had a technical issue, and I decided for this episode I wanted a cup of Nicole coffee, right? So we got some Nicole Sauce Hollow Roast coffee going on here, and we're going to have a good time today. We're going to talk about mostly current events. Hopefully most of them are directly relevant to your life. One of them isn't, and it's actually going to be our lead story today, that really isn't directly relevant to your life. Some of you might believe that it is, but it isn't. But it actually is from a standpoint of it is a case study in propaganda. So we're going to talk about propaganda today. We're going to talk about school closings, and I don't mean the kind they do for winter. I mean the permanent kind that I've been forecasting since right before, I mean heavily forecasting, right before the pandemic started. And then during the pandemic, I said, look, here it comes, boys. This just accelerated it by 5 years. There's a lot of dynamics at play, but one is actually a declining population. That has other implications for us. We're going to talk about Russia's economic growth plummeting since Trump took over, but it actually doesn't directly have anything to do with Trump, sort of. But it actually changes the dynamics of negotiations over the Ukraine conflict. We're going to talk about Bitcoin quite a bit today. JP Morgan and Jamie Dimon have done a complete 180 on Bitcoin, a complete 180. Not like, oh, yeah, we're helping BlackRock with their ETF, right? Because they're just a customer, like a total 180. Fold has some interesting news out about Bitcoin right now. A major bill is about to pass in the Senate, go over to the House and get a rubber stamp. It affects stable coins, but has more to do with Bitcoin than you might think. We're going to talk about some other things too, some cool things. With biochar, Minneapolis is going to become the first city in North America to own and operate a biochar production facility. When governments start getting involved, even governments like the city of Minneapolis, things tend to explode. Right? There's a lot of money that government steals, and when they start spending it, they can make a lot of things happen. So that just is indicative of what's going on in the biochar world. And then you're surely got some press, and not for my new book either, for my bioreactors. It's a little publication called the Columbia Star. It's not huge, but honestly, the people that did it never had to actually mention me. It's pretty cool, though. These folks up at Rosewood Community Orchard decided to start making better compost, and they're actually following my method, and I'll share that with you. And we've got some other stuff to cover today as well. Before we get into it, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor day number one today is Above Phone. With Above Phone, you can take back your technology, and you have many options in doing that. Above Phone makes really great, really secure, really private phones that use their own private operating system. They also make tablets and the Above Book. All of them are a step up from what you're using right now with branded products from either Apple or Microsoft, is what most people are using, or Android with the carriers on the Google side for phones. And with this, you can actually keep your data private, your communications private, your app usage private. And if there is an app that you need to use that's just not available with a replacement on their own private app store, you can use the conventional app, but you put a little jail cell where it only does what it does when you let it out because you want to use it. It just gives you a much greater control of your life. MSB members get $75 off any phone at Above Phone. And when you buy a device from Above Phone, they'll give you a free onboarding consultation call to help you learn how to use your new device. And if it's a phone, to transfer over from using your legacy phone from your mainstream carrier and your mainstream device manufacturer, where everybody spies on you and everybody sells your information to everybody else. Next up today, the Wealthsteading podcast with John Pugliano. You know, I say this all the time, but it's the truth. John is one of us. He's not just some investment advisor clown that came to me one day and said, hey, I want to sponsor the show, because I would have frankly said no. John is a prepper. He's a ham radio operator. He has his garden. He has his food storage. He's just a prepper like the rest of us. He also did something most investment managers didn't. He made himself a liquid millionaire before he ever took anybody else's money on. he didn't get his job by responding to an ad in the paper for, like, you know, American Express financial advisors or something like that, or jump in through a network marketing thing like Primerica reps do or something like that. He's actually an individually licensed investment manager that runs his own company. He manages his customers' money the way that he manages his own. And he does a podcast that tells you what he's doing with that management practice so that if you're not retaining him, you can take his wisdom and use it yourself or discuss it with your own advisor. It's called the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. And I recommend that you do that. Listen to his show. It's pretty short and it doesn't come out that much. Now, I think I said that our lead story today was not relevant to your life. And I'm wrong. It's the second story. The lead story we have today is actually relevant to the life of everybody in the Western world, definitely the developed world, definitely, but definitely to American citizens, because this is what's hitting us in America, where this is happening all over the world, by the way. Even in a lot of countries, if you think of having huge populations like China, have a declining population. Their reproduction is not at what's called replacement rate. Real quick before we go on, when I talk about China, people think that, well, since they have over a billion people, in fact, almost 2 billion people, if they lost half their people, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. When you've already built a society, you've built social programs on taxing people, et cetera, and you've devised all your inputs based on a population baseline and it growing, and then that doesn't happen, everything starts to fall apart. Everything starts to fall apart. What am I talking about? I'm talking about school closures. So this, I just heard this morning. Apparently it's been announced a couple of times, but it's now finally approved. It was on my local news station, Fox News 4. And the headline is Fort Worth ISD school closures. These are 18 campuses on the list. So they're closing 18 schools over the next 5 years in Fort Worth Independent School District. And it's going to save, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars that the school district currently doesn't have. So what I mean by that is they're like, I think $17 million in the hole right now. And Fort Worth School District is not a premium school district that people are really trying to get their kids into. They have some good schools in Fort Worth, but those Fort Worth schools are in areas that are pretty far from what you think of as Fort Worth. They're really more like areas that are like Keller, but they're right on the line, so it's still Fort Worth School District. And there's some weird things that happen with school districting in Texas that don't make sense unless you're from Texas, and then they still don't make sense. Here's an example. I lived in Arlington when I started the show. My son was in high school when I started the show. God, that's crazy. But my son went to Mansfield area high school, even though we lived in Arlington and paid Arlington taxes, but we also paid Mansfield taxes. It doesn't make sense. I said, you know, today's show is about making sense. We'll never make that make sense. It just is what it is. But my point is, like, this is not a great school district to begin with. 18 campuses is a lot. It's a significant portion of the total. And so why is this happening? And to really understand the impact of this, you have to think about a couple things that, you know, this article doesn't point out. One of those things is that Texas is one of the biggest growth states in the country right now. Like California, when schools close, well, people are leaving the entire state. Like they have a net loss of population. Texas has a net gain of population in the last 5 years, significantly so. And yet, what's going on? So what's really going on is our population looks more stable than it is, because people live longer. And since they don't die, they remain part of the population. And I don't really think people have grasped how true this is. And it's taking a while for statistics to really catch up to it. And what I mean by that is, when I was a kid, an old man was 66, 67 years old. And not from my perspective, that's what people thought. And if a guy died in his late 60s, people were like, that's too bad. He still had some years left in him. But, you know, they were thinking his life was shortened by, what, 5 years? You know, he was 67. He should have made 72, 73, 75. If a guy died at 75, people were like, now a guy does it 75. People are like, damn, what happened? They don't just take it as a matter of, like, we have a lot of men living into their 80s now. In fact, the majority of men that make it to 60 make it to 80. That didn't used to be the case. Women are routinely living into their 90s now, and many women are getting really close to the centenarian mark before they go out. So we're having the population look more stable than it is because the top is getting bigger and the bottom's getting smaller and they're canceling each other out. The reality is we are in a terminal population decline. And then for the schools, not only do they have that problem, they also have the problem that homeschooling has taken a huge chunk, way bigger than the official number of about 4 million children are being homeschooled. There are a lot of children that I believe are being homeschooled in programs like ACELLIS that some states consider to be homeschool and other states don't, and parents maybe don't exactly report it as homeschooling. See, the thing about a program like ACELLIS, which my grandchildren use, is they're registered to a school. They're technically not being homeschooled, even though they do their school at home. I'm not sure that all of the kids that fit that basket are in that 4 million, 4.5 million number. I think that number is much larger. I also think that there's a very good chance that students like my granddaughter, Tegan, who's never darkened the door of a K-8 public school, they're unknown to them. They don't really know of her at all. They're not in any official number. And public schools don't really necessarily want to report all of the notifications they have of homeschooling because they don't like it and they don't want that trend to grow. So we have a lot more homeschooling going on. Plus, we have the enrollment cliff, which is simply less young people coming in. And this is why everywhere you look at this is happening. Fort Worth, Plano, these are local-ish areas. I mean, Fort Worth is right there for me. Plano is a good hour and a half away, but that's only because of traffic and how you have to go to get there. I mean, I used to live just south of here, and I worked north of Plano. It's pretty local. Plano closed a lot of schools, and unlike Fort Worth, they're a very affluent school district, and they're closing six schools by the end of this next school year. But where are they all doing it? It's all starting at the K-8 level. K-8s go first. 9-12 high schools go second. So what you'll see is the district say, well, we're closing five schools, and you look at it, and it's four K-8. You know, it's like an elementary and a middle school and another middle school and another elementary school and one high school. Well, that's because the ball is shrinking as it goes through the pipe, right? So there's still more. There's more high school students right now. Let's say you're 9-12. Then there is like 1-4. So first to fourth graders, there's less of the 9th to 12th graders. On top of all this, the colleges are shitting a brick over this. And this is what I've talked about. It's starting. Even though it started 5-6 years ago, it's really starting to actually take the effect and impact. And you're going to start seeing more and more of these schools close. And it will work its way up the chain. The situation will get worse for the K-8. And then it will start getting worse for the 9-12. But while the 9-12 is collapsing, so will the K-8. And eventually that will completely shit can over into the fake fiat-based college education system, which has become a significantly massive piece of our economy. And that whole thing is about to collapse in the next 5 years. And I don't mean to all go away and Harvard won't exist. You know, God willing, Harvard won't exist, but it will. Okay? What I mean is, that's where you'll start to see this happen at the collegiate level in about another 5 years. In another 2 or 3 years, it's really going to start impacting the high schools. It'll only take about 3 more years to hit the colleges, even so it seems like that timeline's accelerated. But there's more as to why. More and more people are going, college doesn't make sense. Everybody should go to college. It was a lie that we told people for 30 years, and it worked out okay for 20 of them. And now a college degree, unless it's in something specific, doesn't mean anything anymore. There's a surplus of them, and they cost more than they're worth. And sooner or later, even in a fiat fake economy, reality of the market will correct. And the market's correcting right now. More and more students are looking at coding boot camps, trade work, etc. More and more women still want to go, but they're not getting the jobs that they thought they would get because they have the degree that doesn't actually do anything. And so this whole thing is falling apart. And this is back to what I was talking to you guys about 5 years ago. People do not understand the dramatic impact on the economy as a whole this is going to have. There are little towns all throughout this country, and we've talked about how the industrialization of America was gutted, and some of these towns survived on colleges. Some of these towns survived on relatively small colleges with a total enrollment of 8,000 to 12,000 students, but it's a town of like 8,000 to 10,000 people. There's a student per resident. That's why there's a Chili's and a bar and a bowling alley and whatever else. Because that you take that college away, and all of those kids that are there, kids, young adults that are there, 9 months out of the year aren't. But all of the people that work at the colleges don't have a job. And all the people that do work that is fed by the people at the don't have jobs, or their whole industry declines. A whole new giant sucking sound. And it's beginning. And this is a larger problem, and I'm not sure that as optimistic as I am about some of the moves being made right now economically, that this doesn't really hurt us more than anything else. More than some bad actor country, more than a tariff. When you have a declining population and a social welfare economy, you have a problem. And whether you realize it or not, we have a social welfare economy. I bet you half of the people in this country some way depend on money from the government. Whether they're paid for a job they do for the government, whether it's state, local, or federal, the ones that are, you would say, are completely legitimate, you know, that's a Social Security recipient. They paid in their whole life. They'll never get back what they put in. It's bullshit. They should get what they have. But it doesn't matter if the money's not there. And then the only solution becomes to print more. We already talked about that yesterday. So it's like, you understand this is a problem, but this is also a Jack told you it was coming. And there's still people resisting that this is happening, but this will become imminently obvious to even the most casual observers soon. On top of this, you know what we just did in Texas, which I think is a good thing, but it will make this problem worse for public education. We passed school choice. So not only can I say, you know what, I think school A sucks, and I think school B is doing a better job, and even though where I live says my kid goes to school A, I'm going to put them in school B, and I can just move them to another school, and there's nothing that they can do to stop it anymore. I can also homeschool, and I can get money to aid with homeschooling. There's a lot of people that when they do the math, and they look at it, and they go, okay, if mom and dad both work, and we send the kids to school, we're ahead by 5 to 10%, and 5 to 10% is enough to, like, yeah, we need to keep doing this. But you throw in a few $1,000 per kid, changes the math. Now we're break even if one parent stays home, and if that parent can get remote work that pays even half of what they were making, they're ahead. They're ahead. And that's going to happen more and more too. So this is a giant problem. The school is only analogies are what I like to do. So let me, if you're familiar with how mushrooms work, what you see pop up that we call a mushroom is really the fruit of the fungi, the mushroom, the mycelium. So you have this log. And you walk through the woods and you go, oh, look, those are mushrooms. And you go look closer. You go, oh, those are good mushrooms. They're pearl oysters or whatever, right? They're chicken of the woods, whatever they are. And you go, wow, look at that. And you have this big pile of mushrooms. And you take that, put it in a bag, and take it home and eat it. What was much bigger was how much mycelium was in that log that's been completely consumed at the point where it's starting to pop out and reproduce itself to go colonize other logs, okay? The school is the mushroom. The population collapse underlying it is the mycelium. And that will eventually cause the log to collapse. Instead of like the log gets smaller, the log just goes to dirt. The fungi are the teeth of the soil, so to say. Now, let's move on to something different. This is the one that I said doesn't directly affect you, but it affects you if you allow it to. In a positive way, in better understanding the world, and propaganda that will be constantly used against you. So when we look at the Biden presidency, it's obvious that we were being lied to the entire time, unless we still just want to be a special child stick our fingers in our ear and pretend that it isn't true because Trump makes us mad. Any logical, rational person knows that from the day Biden was elected, he was not mentally competent to be president of the United States. He was the placeholder for the Democratic Party to run the presidency. That's it. Or whatever conglomerate group was behind him that was actually running the auto pen. We also just found out, miraculously, out of nowhere, Biden has prostate cancer. And it's very advanced and metastasized to the bone. And if you go listen to what any experts are saying, any medical experts are saying about what's being reported about this type of cancer, they're like, yeah, he had cancer when he was president. I mean, even people on like MSNBC and CNN, where the hosts are like, what? What did you just say? Well, the doctor just like, I'm a doctor. You can't ask me it's not COVID anymore. You can't ask me a medical question and not get a medical answer. Like, this just doesn't work that way. And in the Hail Mary that they didn't know is, but, you know, once men get over 80, a lot of times they stop screening for prostate cancer. Not when you're president of the United States, and maybe it's not the finger in the butt, but it would be the PSA in the blood levels. And you got to imagine the president of the United States probably have his blood drawn at least once a month. I mean, they tested the guy for COVID every 5 minutes, but they didn't check his PSA levels. Come on. The dude had cancer, and 2 years before the election, he said in a speech that he had cancer. Guess what? Guess what? Delaware has the highest amount of cancer in the whole country. My son had cancer, and I have cancer, right? Something like that. That wasn't him being Dementia Joe. That was him, because he was Dementia Joe, actually saying the quiet part out loud. He knew he had cancer. He's known he's had cancer. We all knew something was wrong with him. The propaganda lesson, though, isn't that he had the cancer. My belief is they plan to not talk about it. As much as it's aggressive in advance, it's actually a fairly treatable form of prostate cancer because it's responding to hot hormone. Well, they're discussing treatment options. There's really one path forward if you're going to treat, and it will probably give him as much life as you could expect out of a guy who has dementia and won't know his own name in another 6 months. The plan was probably either never say it or toward the very, very end say, oh, and he has cancer. But something else happened, didn't it? What happened just a few days ago? Remember those transcripts of the Robert Hur interview when the prosecutor Hur said, I think there's a crime here, but I'm not prosecuting the president of the United States under these circumstances. No jury would ever convict this guy. He doesn't know where he is. And, of course, the Democrats, oh, no, this is the best Biden ever. It just means he's not guilty. Well, then what happened is not only do you have a transcript, and when you read something, you put your own voice and tone into it. I remember back when I was in high school and we actually studied real literature in high school, and we read, I think it was in 10th grade, Julius Caesar. And then we all had discussions, because we actually used to do that too, about, you know, was Brutus really honorable? Was Caesar really ambitious? And was that really worth killing? Like all this mindset. And then we watched a movie based on the play, and then the actor's inflection actually changed a lot of people's opinions. Now, the teacher pointed out, like, the actor puts themselves into it, the director tells them how to do it. But my point is that when you hear somebody vocalize a thing, it's different than reading it flatly. Well, when they released the Hur tapes, people were like, holy shit. Holy shit. This is what this guy was really like the whole time without people surrounding him, containing him, moving him out of the way. Because we all saw how bad that was, but it was so much worse. Then miraculously, oh, he has cancer. Then what comes next? I said this yesterday to my wife, and this morning I woke up and it's everywhere. I'm like, by tomorrow morning, there'll be 100 paid TikTok type influencers, Instagram influencers, etc., all over the place saying, leave Joe alone. The poor guy has cancer. And here it is. Now, how could you know that? Because it's a pattern that consistently repeats itself. Here's the thing that people are discussing that we don't like them talking about. Here's something to draw their attention away from it. And now here is the modern, you know, Web 3.0 version of let's reinforce the secondary thing. So the bride and prostate cancer is the pretty chick with big boobs standing next to the magician who's distracting you while the magician is pulling his bullshit. Am I saying the Bidens are in on this? No, they could have just been told it's time. It's time. We're going to release it, so it'd be better if you did. Maybe they are in it. I don't know. I think Joe's not in on anything. The takeaway from this, though, yes, it's bullshit. No, it doesn't really affect you. The Bidens will never pay for what they've done, ever. They'll never pay for it. They got away with it. They're going to get away with it. The only solace you might have is the family itself is going to go bankrupt because they have nothing to sell now because they never had anything of value except access to Joe Biden as a senator and later as a vice president and later as a president. That's the only value the Biden family has ever brought to the world as a grifter. So the whole family was living off Biden Inc., run by Hunter and his and Joe's brother, Jim. And now that's gone. But as far as anybody going to jail or anything, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. The lesson here is the propaganda lesson. You need to expect that this will always, 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 and I mean always happen every single time this is going to happen. When something's going on that the people in power do not like you paying attention to, they're always going to substitute something. This just happened to fit perfectly. I don't believe for a minute. And I think anybody that believes for a minute that the idea that they just found this out is valid, you have to be, you're not even stupid. No one is that stupid. Anybody stupid enough to believe that, to genuinely, legitimately believe that, is too stupid to pay enough attention to know what happened. You're talking sub 75. You're talking legitimate special needs. Living in a home your whole life and having people guide you so you don't harm yourself or others. That's how dumb you'd have to be. And those people, by and large, are not paying attention to this. I'm sorry. You have to be intentionally, severely, willfully ignorant to believe anything that you hear about that right now. Let's move on, though. Let's talk about Russia. And this is completely legit, even though it's Breitbart. And I'm not picking on Breitbart. I'm just saying it's a Western media source talking about Russia. So there was a very similar report on Russia today. So the Russian official news front is saying the same thing. Russia's GDP plummets after Trump takes office. And it's by about 75%. It was a little over 4% in the last quarter last year. And it's now a little over 1% this year. That's the growth in the domestic product of the entire country is down that much. There's all kinds of consternation. Did Trump do this with sanctions on Russia? Trump ain't done dick with sanctions on Russia. He's talking about lifting some. The sanctions were willfully and woefully ineffective against Russia. Russia did not give a fuck about the sanctions. It went on and it grew. They tanked the ruble overnight when Biden made that, well, when Biden's handlers made that move in the very beginning, and it immediately rebounded. And then they basically came into a very incestuous relationship with China, which was obvious. And then everything that Biden did made the cost of living go up, primarily due to the cost of one major component of the economy that drives the cost of all others, and that would be energy. So there's a very simple answer to what happened here. There's a one-word explanation as to what happened here. And the word is oil. Oil is what happened here. And if you're on the video, what I have right now is a graph. The last 5 years, the price of oil. The price of oil over, I think it's, let me make sure I got that adjusted. No, that's 1 year. Let's get to 5 year. Okay, that's a 5 year graph of oil. And I knew that was wrong because if we go back here, this is as we head into the pandemic, right? This is where we're coming at. You know, we're already in the pandemic here. We're back to, what is that, 525, 2020. So we're well into the pandemic. Of course, oil went almost negative, like futures on oil were negative. But then, of course, as the pandemic waned, at least in people being willing to stay locked down, as soon as people started to go back outside, the price of oil went up. And then it peaked in about 2022. And then under Biden, it stayed mostly above $70 a barrel. And I'm looking for a point where it's about $70 a barrel, right there in the center. on 3-2023, 69-67. That's good enough for government work, right? So if you look at that line right now, every place the graph is above that line, and this is, you know, like right dead center of the Ukraine conflict, every place that the line is below the mean of the graph, the economy in Russia works really well. Russia loves $70 oil. Russia makes lots of money on $70 oil, about $10 a barrel. What does that mean? What does that mean when we go here, where we are today, and we're at $63.67 a barrel? And I'm sorry, at 70 bucks, yeah, they're making about 10, right? Yeah. So now they're making 3. And gee, their domestic product collapsed from 4.1 to 3.1. How'd that happen? You're looking at it. So what did Trump do? When Trump took over, right about here, Trump immediately began enacting policies that drove the price of oil down and immediately began rhetoric that meant that traders were betting on the price of oil going down, thereby becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, what you're looking at right now is 100% because of the cost of oil, and it's one of the major leverage points against Russia, and the truth is it's one of the only leverage points against Russia. Sanctions don't mean anything. Russia has enough natural resources and production capacity, even though they're in a population decline, it seems worse than ours, but they have that. And they have enough trade partners who will trade with them no matter what we say for what they don't have, that they're fine. They can feed themselves, and they can manufacture everything that they need, and they can do business with China, and they're even doing business with many of our so-called allies while they have sanctions, and the allies are just like, yeah, we're sorry we're doing this anyway. But what happens when oil goes below 70 bucks, Russia starts to hurt. Russia's dream, as long as current economics stay about where they are, you got to factor inflation into this over like 50 years, but it's a permanent oil price of 75 to 85 bucks. If oil goes too high, it actually becomes a problem. I'm not going to get into why today, but it does. And if it goes below 60, it's a disaster. And if it gets into the 50s, then they're totally effed. And it's heading for the 50s next. And there are certain things the United States can do, certain policies the United States can enact that can further that. The balancing act is this hurts U.S. oil production companies too. But it benefits big oil production companies. It hurts the small producer. So what happens is the small producers either cut back and wait to come back in or they get sucked up by the big ones. In any event, U.S. oil production can survive and even thrive at, let's say, $57 a barrel. At $57 a barrel and down to even 55, the numbers work. At 55, Russia is throwing money away for every gallon of oil that they pump. That's just, they're literally losing money. Now, it's worse for them than it would be for the United States. In the United States, you know, companies extract oil and companies refine oil and companies make money on oil and then companies pay taxes to the government, of which the oil companies pay very low taxes because they're very good at spending the money one way or another and reinvesting it and continuing to grow the underlying value without actually generating a lot of profit as it pertains to paying taxes anyway. Russia doesn't work that way. Russia has free healthcare. You want free healthcare, millennials and Gen Zs? Go to Russia. They'll have you, and they won't. You have to be productive to go to Russia in more than one way if you want to go there permanently. And most of you that say you want free healthcare, you're not. Well, anyway, they have to pay for it. It's not free, right? It's never free. Somebody has to pay for it. The way Russia funds healthcare and a lot of their social welfare, and they have a lot of it, way more than we do, is by government owning certain industries outright, profiting from them, and then taking the profits and giving them back to the people, which sounds like a great idea until you're not making money anymore. And unlike the United States government, that when one industry declines, another industry expands, and their tax revenue remains very constant, because for all the talk that the corporations don't pay taxes, first of all, yes, they do. Second of all, every employee of that corporation pays income tax. Where do you think all that money comes from? Additionally, the really, you know, important people, the big people, the C-level people, the director-level people in these companies have massive salaries that they also pay huge amounts of personal income tax on. So the person you're vilifying is actually paying the tax. The corporation has retained earnings and asset value expansion that's only realized if it's sold off. So that's how that all works. But for the United States, it's a much more stable system than for Russia. In other words, the United States will have no difficulty paying for its welfare recipients of all types because the oil price went down. In fact, if the oil price goes down, other segments of the economy boom, and the United States government benefits highly because we are a very industrious nation in spite of deindustrialization. When I say industrious, we do a lot of shit. We have a lot of output. Russia's 20 years ahead of us in this decline. Russia's got a declining population every year. It's actually going down. Not accounting, you don't have to worry about losses from the war. I'm talking about just reproduction. So this is a leverage point. Now, how does this play into the Ukraine-Russia conflict? It's the only real pinch point the orange man has. He spent 2 hours on the phone with Putin yesterday. I'm sure he's telling Putin this. You got to give me something, bro. You want me to go strong arm the little transgender dancer comedian guy, then I got to have something. You have to give something up. Putin's response is, why would I give anything up? I've won the war. You don't give anything up when you sacrifice blood and treasure and you're winning. And anybody that doesn't think Russia's won the war at this point is retarded and I can't help you anymore. You're done. There's no getting through to your thick ass bone skull if you think that Ukraine has done anything here other than murder almost an entire generation. If actually, I would say they murdered an entire three generations of men. They have 60-year-olds and 20-year-olds both dying at the front right now in numbers that are hard to imagine for a country that has a population or started with a population about the size of the state of Texas. I don't think we'll realize that, you know, there's just not that many people in Ukraine either. And so now what Trump has is a squeeze. The squeeze on Ukraine's easy. You got to give some or we'll just cut you off. And Trump already basically said that publicly in front of Zelensky and Vance at the White House. So we know he'll squeeze those balls. But if you want to get two sides to negotiate and you're an intermediary, if they squeeze each other's balls, they both get enraged and they'll fight to the death. If the intermediary pinches a little bit on both sides are like, ugh. And the goal here is to come out of this with Ukraine and Russia both friendly to the United States, even if they're not to each other. And that's why Orange Man has rolled out a whole litany of ways that Russia will profit from trade with the United States as soon as the war is over. When they keep telling you, but Putin's not serious about peace, he's dragging his feet. Well, here's the proposal from Ukraine. Give us all the land back. Let us join NATO still. Let us have security guarantees, i.e. EU troops inside Ukraine. And Putin's like, yeah, fuck that. That's not happening. Now, I think Putin has now taken over like four provinces in Ukraine, and this all started over two. Maybe he gives up one of those. Maybe. The only way that happens, though, is Ukraine is going to have to like recognize Crimea and Donbass and Luhansk. That's what's going to have to happen. Like, there is people still think this is going to go back to like 2014 borders or some shit. It's not. I'm not 2014. I'm sorry. Like 1996 borders. Like Crimea, no, that was never even in play here. It's retarded. But I'm going to tell you, there's more to this story. This country has way more oil than you know. And you know what Trump hasn't done yet? It's very interesting to me. It could be done like that at any moment. Have the Keystone pipeline completed and start pumping oil out of Canada to the United States. You know why that hasn't happened yet? Because he's still dicking around with 51st state bullshit and he's still trying to negotiate with the Canadians a better trade deal. And if we turn the Keystone pipeline on and we bring oil in from Canada down to Houston where we can actually refine their shitty oil because it ain't like Texas sweet crude at all and they can't refine it themselves and that's why they're shipping their freaking overseas now to have it refined. if he does that, it benefits Canada a lot from a trade perspective. It's us buying a shitload more of their oil than we already do. And it hurts U.S. oil production capacity. So the deal has to be in place first. So if you've been wondering what's going on there and why Trump hasn't turned the Keystone back on when he was such a fan of it in the beginning, it's because now he's engaged in this this contentious negotiation with the Canadians. I guarantee you there's a lot of things said the back end of these negotiations that are not said publicly. And I guarantee you there are people telling, what's his name, Carney up there, you want to sell Canadian oil into the United States? You want us to refine your oil? You want that sweet deal? You got to make a bigger sweet deal or we're not going to turn it back on. Because if Trump could turn it on with an EO and Biden can turn it off with an EO, then Trump could turn it right back on. The play has to be such, though, if they want it to remain in place, that it goes fully operational before the next president takes over, assuming the next president is a Democrat. If it's Vance or one of the people out of the fold there, then it's got more time. But you can't bet on that. So that's what's going on there. So Adrian says, can I speculate if there was already a first woman president? I guess he means Dr. Jill. No, I don't think so. I think that Jill's job was to keep Biden from falling on his face and take care of him like a hand nurse and maybe have a little bit of input. But I think that they're basically Biden's cabinet ran the government. That's what I actually think happened. People say it was Obama or whatever. Why, if I'm Joe Biden's cabinet, why am I going to let Obama run the government? The people in those levels, they want power. And if they have a weak president, the last thing they go is look for another one. They run the government. So Biden's cabinet. And you go, well, why was it run so incompetently? Look at Biden's cabinet. Biden's cabinet and the top level bureaucrats of the very large federal agencies ran the government with no oversight because Biden wasn't capable of giving oversight. That's what I would say there. Though the first woman president is an interesting joke, kind of like the joke that Bill Clinton was the first black president. If you've never heard anybody say that, you can look up the rationale behind it. All right, let's move over to some Bitcoin news. And there's some big freaking news going on here. Setting the stage, and this is, I'm not going to cover this for very long, but it does fold into everything else. And that's kind of an unintentional pun because of the next story. It involves fold. But JP Morgan Chase, CEO Jamie Dimon, makes stunning reversal on Bitcoin. And what they basically said is they're going to allow, isn't that nice of them? They're going to allow JP Morgan Chase banking customers to buy Bitcoin. That's very nice of you to let your customers spend their own money in ways that make them happy, which is actually your job as a bank. But this is not just like, oh, I had JP Morgan and I tried to move some money to Gemini so I could buy crypto and Bitcoin and I couldn't do it. They're not just going to allow stuff like that. Long term, what they're signaling is you're going to be able to be a JP Morgan customer and inside your bank account buy and hold Bitcoin with all the safety and security of the bank. Let's see if they allow you to save self-custody, because without that, it's crap. And I wouldn't really recommend anybody necessarily do it this way anyway, but it's good for Bitcoin. But the big thing is, if you think of Jamie Dimon's comments on Bitcoin just a few years ago, it's a shiny object, it's worthless, it's backed by nothing, it's like a fool's gold. If you buy it, you're an idiot. No one should buy Bitcoin. JP Morgan will never, ever, ever touch this crap, right? I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said. And he was enemy number one of Jack Mahler's of Strike. And Jack so much as said so multiple times in multiple interviews, saying that he was getting back channel communications. Dimon is coming for you. He's not coming for you with competition. He's coming for you at the regulatory level. Well, the regulatory level just went down the toilet. And I'm not talking like the toilet in your house. I'm talking about like one of those airplane toilets where if you push it while you're sitting on it, you get your ass sucked to it, you can't get up because it's like, woof. I'll explain that, not the next bullet, but the one after that. That has sailed out the effing window. It's way bigger than Trump signing an EO about a crypto, you know, friendly policy and a Bitcoin reserve. This is much bigger. And for this man to reverse course this hard means that somebody, him or his lackeys, put their finger up in the air after they licked it, felt the breeze and realized the breeze was a fucking tornado and said, well, we have to capitulate. This is full capitulation is what this is. Now, before we move on to the big news, just a little extra Bitcoin news that's really cool, I think. Story in Bitcoin Magazine today. Fold unveils Bitcoin gift card, pioneering Bitcoin in the U.S. retail gift card market. What does that mean? It's exactly what it sounds like. You go buy a gift card and you give it to somebody and it's worth whatever you paid for it, minus some spread fee or something like that in Bitcoin. Meaning like when you email me, go, Jack, I want to buy $100 worth of Bitcoin for both of my nephews and I don't know how. Now you do. It's that simple. You go in your Fold app, buy, and you give them the gift card. Yay. I think it's big. It's not going to change the price of Bitcoin. Certainly, it's not going to do it overnight. It is an interesting idea, but it's also incredibly viral. And it is one of the most brilliant marketing moves I have ever seen a company do. Because how do you think you redeem your gift card if you receive one? Let's say that I decided that American Legend, who's sitting here in our chat, deserves $100 worth of Bitcoin, so I went and bought him a gift card. I'm sure it's an electronic gift card, so it's basically a code, like when you buy an online Amazon gift card and you enter your code and boom, it's in your balance, right? So how do you redeem an Amazon gift card? Do you take the Amazon gift card to JCPenney's or Walmart and say, I want to buy this thing with an Amazon gift card? No, they tell you to go get effed. If you're using it for nefarious purposes, you may sell it on the black market for 75 cents on the dollar. That's done all the time. It's one of the major criminalized currencies on the planet is Amazon gift cards because you can buy anything you want from them. But in general, the way you redeem an Amazon gift card is you go to your Amazon account. So how, pray tell, would your nephew or American Legend or Adrian here or Hey Hey Alabama who's in chat or Angie or Jeremy, right? How would any of you, if Jack Spirko sent you a Fold gift card, how do you think you'd redeem it? Well, you'd go to Fold and you'd set up an account and then you would stick your code in and then all of a sudden you would have Bitcoin. What do you have now? You have a Fold account. See how smart that was? Kind of wonder why nobody else did it yet. That's one of those things that when you look at it as a marketer, you go, from one marketer to the other, I'm impressed. My heart goes out to you. Well done. Beautiful play. Even if I don't like you, I have to, like, that's one of those things I got to acknowledge. That was genius. So what they envision and probably will happen is Bitcoiners are very enthusiastic about being Bitcoiners. A Bitcoiner using a service like Fold is another level of Bitcoiner, right? A Bitcoiner using Fold is totally different than a Bitcoiner that, you know, gets the Strike app or gets River or anything else and just buys some Bitcoin or goes on Swan and buys Bitcoin and once a month withdraws to a cold wallet. Like, this is a different level. This is a person that says, I will change the way I pay my bills in order to stack more sats. That's not just a fan. That's a super fan of Bitcoin. So those types of people are very predisposed to giving Bitcoin to others. But they want to do it in a way where they know that person can't just forget about it and it disappears, like, and waste it. Like, because what would piss me off is I give you $100 worth of Bitcoin today, and 10 years from now, it's worth $10,000, and I ask you what happened to it, you go, I don't know. Well, I would bet you there's an expiration date on these Bitcoin gift cards. There should be. And if they're not redeemed, does Fold get it or does the customer get it? I don't know. If I'm Fold, I'm setting it up so I get it. But if I really want to sell it, I would say, like, I don't know, 90-day redemption. After 90 days, the Bitcoin goes back in your account less a 10% restocking fee, something like that. I don't know. But this is a really cool move by Fold. And it is a cool way to share Bitcoin with others and make sure that they actually have, if nothing else, at least they have a Fold account that can hold it in there. It would be better if they self-custodied. Maybe they never will, but at least they have it. Because Fold, you hold Bitcoin in a custodial wallet, but at least it is a wallet. And you can always recover your password to get into Fold, so you can always get back to your Bitcoin. So I think this will be something that people will do and maybe even say, look, I got you the gift card. Let me set you up a fold right now so we can get the money. And boom, boom, super easy onboarding experience. Now, moving on, though, this is the big news. This is what, like, what you paid the price of admission for is just this. The Senate is about to pass the Genius Act. And because of some discussions about the Genius Visa, I think there's people out there that are not in the crypto Bitcoin space, and they think that has something to do with immigration. It has absolutely nothing to do with immigration. In fact, more so. It is a clean bill for now. I'll tell you some concerns I have about it toward the end of this segment about it being a clean bill. But right now it's clean. In other words, it is only about one thing, and that's stable coins. And you may not think that really has a big impact on Bitcoin, but it has a massive impact on Bitcoin, especially with the administration's stated goals for stable coins and banking and crypto and Bitcoin. All of those are separate baskets, right? And this was one of the best moments ever yesterday in the Senate. Cynthia Lummis, who is a Democrat, and only a Democrat could have done this, whipped up at least 16 Democrat senators to support this. This will fly through the House when it gets thrown over the fence. And there's enough Republican support to go with the 16 Democrats to get it out of the cloture vote, which it passed yesterday, of 60. So that got it out. The entire time this was happening, our favorite fake Indian, Foxahonist Elizabeth Warren, was standing there looking like an angry old school teacher that was pissed off and couldn't do anything about something. Like, she's mad at what the kids are doing, but it was graduation day and they were done and they all had their diplomas and she had to just sit there and look at it and fume. And I mean, literally 6 hours, this woman barely moved and stood there like a fuming statue. It was gorgeous. It was the first time I've ever used Elizabeth Warren and gorgeous in the same sentence, let alone paragraph even, right? And so anyway, this passed. It didn't pass, but it's good. Like, once you get out of cloture with something like this, it's going to pass. If they didn't want it to pass, they wouldn't let it out of cloture. So what is it? It is a regulation that aims to take stable coins and allow the banks to issue them. Huh? No shit. Who said that was going to happen like 5 years ago? Yeah, some redneck duck farmer, right? And I've got some notes here, and these are actually presenter notes for this segment, and they are in the show notes today. You can actually download this piece of paper as a PDF if you want it when you go to the audio side. But it aims to tightly regulate U.S. stable coins. They must be one-to-one backed with cash or treasuries, and they're going to be backed with treasuries. And as I explain how this works, you'll understand immediately why. So, again, the latest update shows bipartisan support building, led by Lummis, making passage likely. I would say the odds of this passing the Senate now are about 99%. 99%. And you know what it means when it says there's 99% chance it's going to rain at your house. It's going to rain. Bitcoin is not regulated, but it will benefit from more clear stablecoin infrastructure. And what's going to happen is banks will issue compliant stablecoins. JP Morgan Chase is going to issue compliant stablecoins. That's why they made a 180, because it only works with both sides of the equation working to make enough money to make it worth doing. Because I tell you, the first side of you, you're going to be like, huh, they can kind of sort of do that anyway, mostly. And that is, when somebody issues stablecoins, let's say Tether issues stablecoins, have you ever wondered, how does Tether make money? Two primary ways. So you have to give the money for them to make Tether. They don't just, they're not Ripple, where they just like, and just make it and then sell it and profit from it. That's not how a bank, or in this case, a company like Tether, makes Tether. So some entity, Coinbase, wants $100 million worth of it. And so Coinbase gives them $100 million worth of cash, and Tether turns around and gives them $100 million in Tethers, right? One Tether equaling $1. And that one Tether actually equals like 99 cents. But who's counting? Well, the bank is, because they just made 1%. Yeah, and then there's a fee, so there's another 1%. And then there is some level of fees as the network is used to move the tethers around, some of which they get on the back end. But it's all peanuts. They take your dollars, and they don't go buy yachts with them. They go buy U.S. treasuries that are paying, you know, 3.5%. And so they make 3% on your money. And then they let you use their synthetic money while they hold your real money in the form of U.S. treasuries. Now, the U.S. government needs people to buy treasuries right now to keep propping up the debt because they have no plans to stop spending. So they need an influx of money. This guarantees an influx of money. This guarantees mostly domestic money, some international, but mostly domestic money flowing into U.S. treasuries. Now, they need this so bad and they have needed it for so long. What did they do about 15 years ago? And I covered this as it happened. They quietly removed things like money market accounts and dollar-based accounts from 401ks, replacing them with a U.S. government bond fund under the bullshit that it doesn't pay enough. You have to have some return on your retirement, even though the bond funds can lose money. And the money market couldn't lose money. It was a place you could park your money while times were bad inside the vehicle without paying taxes so you could move back into stocks. Well, they took it away to push more money into U.S. debt. This is going to push more money into U.S. debt. See, I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm saying what it is so that you can figure out how to benefit from it. So now they issue the tether. They make the money on the back end. What they're going to do is turn around and allow you to buy and hold Bitcoin in their bank. Then they can set up smart contracts within your bank account so that you can borrow money against your Bitcoin. And now they make interest on you repaying a loan that's over-collateralized and guaranteed never to fail. They've got the government on one side paying them a small interest rate, but there's no way they're not going to get their money because they fund the government. They are the government from a monetary standpoint. They're the ones that issue the money. So they're going to get their 3.5%, 4% from the government, and at the same time, they're going to make 6%, 8% off of you while you're over-collateralized at a 2x loan. You're going to have $100,000 in Bitcoin backing a $50,000 loan. That's how it's going to work. And if for some reason you don't pay, they're just going to close the contract, take what you owe them by the contract from your Bitcoin, and refund whatever's left, if anything, back to you. That's what's going to happen. So this blows up Bitcoin, it blows up stable coins, and there's more to it. Again, Morgan has signaled institutional acceptance. And this is mostly because of regulatory clarity. So it is no surprise that these two things dropped almost simultaneously. Jamie Dimon, the only person I know that hated on Bitcoin more than Jamie Dimon, I guess would be like Peter Schiff. And Peter Schiff really doesn't have any say-so in anything. He's just the guy that sells gold from the Bahamas. You know, Dimon has major influence on regulation, but even he can lose that battle to other people that also have major influence. So once it became apparent, I'm sure that he knew before this even happened because he announced it just before it happened. Somebody told him, hey, Jamie, guess what? This shit fitting to go down. You're going to be left behind. He said, oh, no, I'm not. And I guarantee you they had this contingency plan. Now, there's more. What would be really interesting for you today after listening to this segment is to go back a few weeks and listen to my entire show on what 21 Capital was going to do, because Jack Mallers has come out and basically validated every speculation that I had in that episode. He did an interview, I think, with Nat Burnell, and it's like everything he said, I'm like, I said that, he ain't said that, but if you're doing all those other things, that's probably happening too. So we have to look at that again. The players inside of 21 Capital include Cantor Fitzgerald, Tether, and, I can't think of it now, a bank out of, it's really based in Japan, something bank. But they're not your conventional type of bank. And they're not going to be able to issue stable coins under this. But Cantor Fitzgerald has all, even though they're not what we think of as a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase, Cantor Fitzgerald has all of the requirements as the legislation is written to be able to issue stable coins. You got that? Now, what did I say that 21 Capital was going to do? SoftBank, that's it. Lily Farms. So SoftBank's there. SoftBank can't issue stables under the current regulation without major restructuring. Tether will not be able to issue stable coins for use like this in the United States under the current regulation unless they have a major restructuring. Cantor Fitzgerald could assist in a restructuring of Tether or could even absorb them. It would still be a lot to do. But Tether won't go away because of this. They just might not have as much interest because you'll have completely legitimized government-sanctioned stablecoins or Tether, which has always faced scrutiny for transparency, even though personally I think they're extremely transparent. I really do. I think you can see their holdings if you want to. Okay? So you've got this issue going on here with, well, how does that play out? Tether may face pressure to restructure to stay competitive if Genius passes, but now Tether's inside 21 Capital. Now, what I think people won't get with this on their own, like I think I'm one of the few people that will see what this play really is before it's like, it'll be nobody knows it, then everybody knows it, okay? And if you think about how I laid out 21 Capital, I think that was the same thing. 21 Capital knew what they were doing weeks ago because Jack Maulers and all the players there are deeply involved on the lobbying level as well, at least connected to lobbyists that work on their behalf. And they knew the wind was going to probably blow this way, but they weren't 100% sure, okay? So 21 Capital now is perfectly positioned and can operate under the Genius Act or without it. Okay? Genius passes, they scale with U.S. compliant products via Cantor Fitzgerald. They continue to operate internationally using Tether. See how that works? Because they can be U.S. based, but all that means is they have to follow U.S. regulation within the United States. They can still have international services that are compliant with local ordinances of where they're operating, much as JP Morgan Chase has banks that serve Japan that follow different regulations than they do in the United States. So because Genius passes doesn't mean Tether's gone. It just means it doesn't work domestically inside this model. So that means it passes, woohoo, it fails, woohoo. Okay, it's like a collared stock. I've talked about this before. Let me explain how a collared stock trade works with some really simple numbers to keep it easy in your head. I'm holding a stock, XYZ stock. It's at $10 a share. I'm afraid it's going to lose money. And so I say the most I'm willing to lose is 20% on it. So I buy, pretty inexpensive relative to my investment, something called a put. Okay, it's a short. And so I pay for the privilege that if that stock price drops to 8 or below, I can still sell my stock for 10. Okay? Now, there's usually options are not even called out like that. They're usually the options themselves are traded. But that costs me money. So I turn around and say, but the stock could go up. But it might not. But it could. But it might not. So I turn around and I sell a call option at $12. So if the stock goes up to $12, I have to sell it to somebody at 10, which is what it's worth today. So I haven't lost anything, okay? And then those two options collar the stock. And that stock can even go up to like $11.50. I'm not getting called out. Nobody wants to pay freaking $12 for $11.50 stock. So eventually the two options close out. I still have my stock, and I have my now 15% gain. If it goes up to 12, I still might not get called out. And I can always write another option on both sides of it as it moves. And what this does is it's not a guarantee 100% that you're going to be okay every time. But what it allows for is a consistent regular profit, and it's generally done by professional traders with dividend-producing stocks that they expect to mostly go nowhere, but they're hedging in case they do. And they're creating yield without loss. Because if you do it right, you never lose or you never lose much. You got it? Because the insurance policy was paid for by writing the call, You're the seller of the call and the buyer of the put. There's also a lot of other bullshit you can pull with as the stock corrects, buying it back below where you originally had it. There's a lot of ways you can play that. You don't need to understand all that. Just understand the basic philosophy. I'm making sure that I'm positioned no matter what happens. That's 21 Capital right there. That's 21 Capital right there. They are now better positioned for this bill to pass than anybody else, and they're still fine if it doesn't. There is, honestly, where they're at right now, it will take banks 3 to 5 years to catch up to where they already are before they even exist. The minute this passes, you notice that they said, like, the goal is to start with, when they go public and they announce that their IPO and all, 42,000 Bitcoin or something like that, right? You know what that means? They don't have all the money yet. If they had all the money, if they had all the investors lined up, they would just do it. This bill passes, all the money comes. This bill fails, they have to scrape to get the money there, and they still go on. They're golden either way. This is going to be an amazing, amazing play, and it's going to dynamically change the entire way Bitcoin's looked at. I have some concerns. So I took the text of the bill, I dropped it into ChatGPT, and I said, is there anything in this bill that does not pertain directly to stable coins, the crypto market? Like, is this a clean bill, or is there other bullshit in it? GPT came back and said, that's pretty clean. There's nothing in it about new powers other than for this. There's no, Flowers for Orphans bill attached to it, airline rerouting bills, or, who knows, or redefining the financial relationship so that it includes safety deposit boxes as financial relationships, like was in the Patriot Act. This is not like an 1,800-page bill you have to pass to find out what's in it. So I said, what do you think the odds are that before a final vote, since it is fast-tracked, moving well, highly bipartisan supported, that something gets added on to it as a rider? And it said 70 to 80% based on past performance. And I would say probably more like 90, but okay, I'll run with 80. And I said, what are the 5 most likely things? And it gave me some, and I'm like, yeah. And I said, the one that's actually the worst, though, the one that's the worst, is one of the ways this got to where it is, the Genius Act, is it tightens up regulations. It tightens up KYC requirements, et cetera, which is kind of stupid and redundant because you already have high KYC requirements to have a bank account. It's not like you can go down to like any bank and go, I don't want to open up an account. And they say, give me your ID, your social security number. And you say no, and they still give you a bank account. So you already have very high KYC. It just restates the obvious. Could that spread in other places? Sure. But it doesn't in this bill as it's written. But one of the things that the government has really tried to do is put everybody into a proctology exam with their bank accounts. And they have tried to do that with all transactions exceeding $600, whether it's your bank account, your Venmo, your Zelle, your PayPal, have to be reported to the government. Just simply that they happened. Now, one thing you should know is the government can find all this information out anyway, but it would be easier for them if they all had it reported to them and only over a certain amount, where there's enough money that if they find it, it's probably worth auditing your ass or at least sending you a letter of demand. Because if it's too little, it's not really worth it. You have to pay IRA agents too, right? There's a problem with that number that I see. And that problem is related to a number that Cynthia Loomis is very fond of, $600. So there's this concept that what we should have is what's known as a de minimis rule for Bitcoin, meaning that if we make purchases with Bitcoin individually under $600, this whole capital gain shit goes away. So if I go out and I buy a $200 steak dinner for me and some buddies and I pay with Bitcoin, and that Bitcoin actually cost me $100, right now I need to report it as a gain of $100, even though I spent it, right? Where the de minimis rule would basically treat it like foreign currency. If I had gone to France and came home with a bunch of euros and the euro went up well against the dollar, but it was under, you know, a small amount of money, then when I converted it back to dollars, I don't pay anything on that. If I'm Forex trading, I pay, right? But if I'm just like small amounts like that, it just doesn't matter. Or if I go to France and I get euros, and while I'm there, there's a massive currency fluctuation and it benefits me, and I spend the euros in France, but they don't tax me on that. So basically, up to $600 individual purchases, and I'm sure there would be some overriding cap, like up to X amount a year, it does not count, because otherwise you could just break your purchases up and structure it, and then they'll come after you for structuring anyway. But 600, that's interesting that the two numbers are the same, isn't it? I think there's a high probability they will try to tack on some sort of addendum, amendment, whatever, to this bill that both has the de minimis rule, but also has the reporting requirement. And it will be very camouflaged because the number is known to both sides. So some people that might resist the de minimis thing want the reporting requirement, and some people that would resist the reporting requirement really want the de minimis rule. You see how that works? So I think it's one of those things that, like, overall, this bill is good. Now, let me tell you, the people out there that everything is doom and gloom, the people out there, they're in the Liberty Eeyores. It's never going to work. It's all bad. They're going to put us all in camps. Those people are going to say this is a backdoor to a CBDC. I have a few things to say to that. One, no, because that's not how a CBDC works. And the way you've been accurately describing it for the last 5 years is how it works. And now this thing that is fragmented all over the place that you do not have to use if you don't want to becomes a CBDC. So, no, it's not a backdoor. Definitely it could have capital controls placed on it. If you're holding a bank-issued Tether equivalent, they know you have it, and they could make it impossible for you to spend it, but that's what they could do with your bank account already. So if you're going to use a bank, I don't know how that, as long as you can self-custody, you know, Bitcoin. Or here's the other thing. Like, I don't want a company like Tether to be pulled under this. I want them to stay in the international world. They might move offshore completely, even though they're inside a U.S. entity in 21 Capital, because that gives people the ability to self-custody both dollars and Bitcoin. And there's nothing anybody knew about it. You'd have to force Tether to do the thing that would be the only reason that they're left around. Like, if this passes and Tether stays in this middle ground, then they can say, hey, we want you to do this. And Tether can say, you know, eat my ass. I ain't doing it. There's nothing you can do. And there really isn't anything they can do. But if the banks do it, if Cantor Fitzgerald does it, and they say, we want this guy's assets frozen, they have to do it under U.S. law. See how that works? It's interesting, isn't it? Because even though Tether is part of 21 Capital, they're not only part of 21 Capital. So they can play the game inside and outside at the same time. Is this good? Well, it isn't bad. It isn't bad. It's certainly good for the overall wealth accumulation inside Bitcoin. And it might be a good time for you to start thinking more about that. One more thing on Bitcoin, and we'll move on to my last two topics, which are just kind of fun. I've been asked a lot about two things. A Bitcoin node software rewrite called Knots. And basically what that does is it filters transactions that have, like, non-financial transactions. So these people attaching JPEGs to Bitcoin blocks for a few sats and driving up cost and eating up block space and all of that. But it doesn't actually prevent them from being in the blockchain. And there's this fantasy-ass belief that some people that are big fans of it have, that if just 51% of node runners adopt it, it becomes the new standard. It does not. Not does not. To actually change Bitcoin, you need a combination of 51% of node runners and miners to actually make the change real. You need both. This is not going to happen. It doesn't matter that 7% or 8% of people running a little node box somewhere are running Knots. It doesn't have any effect, and you shouldn't worry about it. And there are people out there making, like, this is like the block wars with Bitcoin Cash all over again or something, and it's, we're going to fight to the, no. until you have a significant movement for filtering these non-financial transactions that's legitimate and is supported by both node runners, and if really you need node runners, you need miners, and you need users to agree, because the market is the final check, right? Until you have that, you're not getting a real change in Bitcoin Core. It's not happening. So I just don't care about knots. Now, the other thing I've been asked about is something called BIP 177, and BIP means Bitcoin Improvement Protocol. There's also a BIP 176, which is like a light version of 177. Neither one of them are going to happen. Let me tell you the reason. I'll tell you what it is, but first I'm going to tell you the only reason that anybody is even talking about anything. There's no reason other than this that anybody's even discussing these Bitcoin Improvement Protocols. Jack Dorsey. Jack Dorsey labors under several fantasies. I like Jack Dorsey overall. I think he's a smart man, but smart men can be wrong. Hell, I've been wrong, and I'm pretty smart, okay? Jack Dorsey believes, first and foremost, people need to spend Bitcoin or it won't succeed. Okay, people spend Bitcoin every day, Jack. I'm sorry, this is other Jack talking to you here. They do. Now, they're not generally running around buying fake tallow fries from Steak and Shake, even though they now take Bitcoin, but a few people are. But Bitcoin is traded daily in the billions of freaking dollars in volume. I think it's around $22 billion a day in volume of Bitcoin trading hands. It's being spent. Mostly what people are doing is they're selling it for dollars and they're buying it with dollars. It's still being spent. People are not spending Bitcoin because of what it's called. And that's what this is all about. What this improvement protocol would do, 177, it'd be they need a different term, like Bitcoin BDP, Bitcoin Damage Protocol, like to make it worse. They would change the name. Okay, first of all, remember always say like, okay, that was always allowed. You could always call it whatever you want to. But basically a Satoshi, a sat, which is the smallest unit of Bitcoin, would become Bitcoin, small b, and 100 million Bitcoins, which is a whole Bitcoin, would become Bitcoin, capital B. And they would take away the decimal. So there'd be less confusion. If you're confused, that's because it doesn't make any fucking sense. It makes, I'm sorry, Jack Dorsey, it makes no fucking sense that would be less confusing. Let's forget about the motivation right now and go, is anybody, I'm going to put it to you this way. If you have taken 5 minutes to try to understand Bitcoin, and I told you that there was a Bitcoin and then it could be fractionalized out to 100 million units per Bitcoin, and they're called Satoshis, that doesn't understand that, then you don't want to understand that. And you're not capable of being an important part of the Bitcoin network anyway and shut up and go away. Like, if somebody wants to understand what a Satoshi is, they can. And the idea is twofold. One is that more people will buy Bitcoin, because right now, like, Bitcoin's $104,000. I can't afford that. There are people that believe that. You know what? They're not going to buy it anyway. That same person's buying fractional stocks on a daily basis on fucking Robinhood and investing their money, right? Bullshit. Don't tell me you can't understand that. I mean, it's impossible for somebody to think they can't understand that. It's ridiculous. But then the other thing is, and Jack doesn't explain why he believes this. If we do that, more people will spend it. What the fuck are you talking about? Do you think anybody's not spending Bitcoin right now because we refer to the smallest unit of as Satoshi? When somebody says, hey, do you take Bitcoin for MSB? Do you think they think they're sending me a whole bit? They're going to pay $104,000 for it? No. They say Bitcoin, and then I say, yes, send me X dollars worth, and they do. Sats never really even enters the equation unless you happen to look at it. This is not complicated. Adrian's got it. Adrian says $1 or a dollar is the same thing. Exactly. Exactly. And no one is confused by a penny. 100 pennies to a dollar. Nobody's confused by that. No one's like, you know what, if we change the name of pennies to dollars and said there's 100 pennies, lowercase, or $100, lowercase d, in a dollar, uppercase d, more people will spend. Like, do you see how dumb that sounds? It sounds so freaking stupid. Now, if you want people to refer to it just as Bitcoin, again, that was always allowed. This is not a problem. This is not a solution looking for a problem. This is a non-solution pretending to be a solution, pretending there is a problem to look for. This is not, of all the issues that need to be solved in the Bitcoin universe, what we fucking call things is not one of them. It takes freaking 1 minute to explain what a Bitcoin is and what a Satoshi is to anybody with an IQ sufficient to have enough income to buy it in the first place. If you're so worried about that, spend more time educating people as to what a Satoshi is. But of all the things I've said about Bitcoin over the years, the one I've never got a follow-up question to is, I don't really understand Satoshis, Jack. How does that work? I don't really get it. I don't understand. I don't understand how mining works. I don't understand how self-custody works. I don't understand why not self-custody is bad. I don't understand how an ETF works, right? I don't understand how I get my dollars in the Coinbase. I've been doing this since 2013. That's 12 fucking years. Then the show 17, but I've been doing Bitcoin for 12 of them. In 12 years, I've never had a single fucking person ask me what a Satoshi is. And not understand. And if they have, it's been like they know nothing. And they say, well, what's a Bitcoin? And I say Satoshi. And they're like, well, what's that? That's the smallest unit. Oh, okay. How many of them are in Bitcoin? 100 million. Oh, okay. It's fucking metric. It's tens. You move the decimal point one decimal for each move up. You get to like 1.0, you're at a whole Bitcoin. It's freaking easy. It's not hard. It's absolutely insane that anybody's even talking about this. Now, I've said it this much, this loud, and this enthusiastically one time so that I can never talk about it again. Because it's never going to happen. And since it's never going to fucking happen, then what you should do is ignore it. It doesn't matter. This isn't going to happen. No one's going to do it. No one's going to accept it. You're not going to get 51% consensus from the miners, the node runners, and the market for this stupidity. And again, the only reason it's even being discussed is Jack Dorsey. If Jack wasn't involved at all in this, everybody would... And think about this. It's BIP 177. There's been a lot of BIPs. A lot less of them passed than passed, right? This happens all the time. Somebody comes with a wild hair in their ass. They want to do a thing. They submit it to the Bitcoin core team. People discuss it. People say yes, no. And there's either enough momentum that it's worth developing or there's not, and there isn't. There isn't. Now, there's a whole astroturfed, bullshit, fake-ass support for it that is not real. I'm sorry it isn't. Or they're Jack Dorsey fanboys, which... Please don't fanboy anybody, not me especially, right? You need to question everybody and everything that they say all the time, or you're not thinking for yourself. This makes no sense. Nobody can make it make sense to me, and nobody ever will, because it will never make sense that people can't understand Bitcoins are made of Satoshis the way dollars are made of cents. Anyway, BIP176 talks about changing the unit name of 100 Satoshis to a bit. Again, that was always allowed. And then you're adding a term. You're mandating an added term. Again, people can call this whatever they want. It's Bitcoin. Relax. It'll be fine. All right, moving on. I've talked a lot about biochar, and it's one of those things I don't want you to stop paying attention to because there is opportunity here, including like home scale production level opportunity, because anybody anywhere can make biochar. It's not hard. Minneapolis will become the first city in North America to own and operate a biochar production facility. I'm not going to go deep into this article. I'm just going to say that what they're going to do is take waste that's readily available, including allowing people to bring the waste to them and use an industrial level kiln system to make biochar, which the city can then use for its own landscaping and purposes like that. It can sell or it can distribute to residents for use. So it solves a waste management problem by producing a very environmentally friendly and high demand product. And all that happens, it's a lot like this Stablecoin Act legitimizing crypto. That's what this will do. Like, this is not going to be big enough to really play into the whole market. The whole market is already measured in billions and billions and hundreds of billions of dollars. This might produce $1 million worth of biochar a year, but hey, that's $1 million that Minneapolis didn't have. Maybe Fort Worth needs one of these. Think about every time you drive down the road and you see one of them trucks pruning stuff off power lines and what have you, and they make wood chips out of it, and you think that, well, they give it to you on chip drop or something. They don't. The vast majority of those trucks pay to have that material to dump it. I talk to people all the time because I'll take all the wood chips I can get, and I have a lot of them, but I would like a lot more. And most of those trucks are driven by people that don't own the truck and they don't own the company. And the company pays them while they're driving the truck, including sitting at line at a place called Silver Creek Materials down the road from me. So they get paid to drive down there. They get paid to sit in line. They get paid to dump it. And they get paid to drive the truck back to the office. So why would they want to dump the trucks in my field and not get paid for that time? And they don't pay the fee to dump the material. But if you have a city taking the material for free, now the owner knows that. He cares. So there is a massive amount of waste material that would be available for this. And it's just a significant growth industry that is going to get more and more powerful. I recommend that you continually learn more about both the industry and the product itself and what it can do for you in your own backyard. It has made an amazing difference for me over the last about 3 years of really using it in earnest in what I'm doing now. I am now, when I take bricks readings on a lot of my leaves in my vegetable gardens, getting bricks as high as 12. And I'm averaging about 8 to 10. This is where you stop having pest problems. Like once you're over a 12, pretty much no insect will eat the plant. It's not the fruit bricks reading. This is the bricks reading of the sap is what I'm talking about. And yes, it has a lot to do with the bioreactor compost, but I believe it has as much or more to do with the bioreactor compost combined effect with the biochar and the housing the biochar is providing. On that note, I thought it was just fun and something I wanted to share with you guys. If you look at the screen right now, if you're watching the screen, there's a picture there, and some of you that have seen pictures of my students here at my place or have been here or went to Nicole's and were part of the bioreactor builds we did up there, when I sent this around on social media, I said, is that you? And there's nobody there that looks like me, but you know what the picture looks like? It looks exactly like every time we do this because they're doing the exact same thing. I mean, they're literally building the bioreactor the exact same way that I build it. And so the way I actually became aware of this article is I have a Google alert for Google News that anything that qualifies for Google News with the words John Spirico, which is my slave name, or Jack Spirico, which is the name I go by, that comes up in Google News, I get an alert saying, hey, there's a story with your name in it or somebody that has your name in it. And so I saw this and I immediately went, is that my, no, that's because the one dude there in the hat on the right, man, he kind of looks like somebody's been to my place a few times. This looks similar, but different. And then I start scrolling down. I'm like, well, where is it? And I found out that they actually used both Dr. Johnson's input and my input on building this. And I can't find my own name right now. Okay, here, I can read it for you. Burke, using the information from Clute, began doing more than planning, looking for something not quite so industrial size. She began searching for a smaller version, because Dr. Johnson's is very industrial size. A Jack Spirico YouTube video offered possibilities. Spirico is a jack of all trades, focusing on growing one's own food. He took Johnson's bioreactor and got rid of everything he didn't need. He was building on small scale and wanted something designed for a backyard gardener rather than a multi-acre food producer. This seemed to be the design that Burke and RCO were looking for. And then they went on to run their stuff and start building these. I'm actually going to reach out to this organization because they were kind enough to make sure that I was named in their article. And the people that run the actual organization, not the newspaper, I am going to give them a free seat in my class on bioreactors if they want it. Because without even taking the class, they got pretty damn close just looking at my publicly available YouTube videos. And they could probably benefit from taking it to another level. And I think it's cool when people use you and then they at least say, hey, this is where I like source your material. On that note, everything I covered today, except for the BIP 177 bullshit, you can look that up for yourself, I've sourced. If you go to the audio notes for today's episode, which is at thesurvivalpodcast.com, or if we're still live, we'll be soon, there's a link in the video notes below that takes you right over there once we're finished and I get it up on that side. Every story, the collapse of public education, Biden's cancer bullshit, Russia's GDP collapse, JP Morgan reversing on Bitcoin, Folds, but everything is there. Everything is there. Links to our sponsors, links to, you know, recommended products, and everything else is in there. So that's all I got for you today, except I will say, again, thank you to all of you who have bought my book, Laws of Life. I would appreciate it. If you haven't gotten a copy yet, please consider doing so. And if you did and you like what you read and you think, I know someone that could benefit from this, maybe have one sent to them. I think that will make them more likely to read it if it shows up in the mail as a gift. You can order it on Amazon and have it shipped right to your friends and family. And more people are posting pictures of them with the book, posting pictures of their dogs with the book, et cetera, on social media. I really appreciate when you do that. If you do it, especially on any of the platforms I'm on, which are primarily Noster, X, and yes, I am back on Facebook after about a five-year hiatus. Yeah, if you tell me you did it, I'll share it to all my people as well, because it benefits me and it benefits you because you get more exposure on social media. So if you can do that, I'd appreciate it. The other thing I'd like to see more of, now that you guys have had the book long enough to at least read part of it, is reviews. I didn't really ask for people to review it right away, because I think a review of a book you haven't even cracked the cover on is not a legitimate review. You know, whether it's positive or negative, it's not legitimate. But, you know, the book's been around for a couple weeks now, and a lot of you have had the book, obviously. So if you started reading it and you really like it, please get over to Amazon and review it for us. That is the number one thing you can do other than buying it to help us reach a broader audience. Remember, the reason we're doing this is to grow TSP's community as a whole, not just so Jack can sell books. With that, thank you for tuning in today. Tomorrow, I will have a great interview for you, and then we'll have, you know, our expert panel show and our Friday flashback. As always, take care, guys. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.